Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Basic Guide to the Just War Tradition, Christian Foundations and Practices, by Eric Patterson, narrated by Kent Kleinman. 1. Just War Statecraft, The Quest for Peace. By the end of 1933, massive swastika flags draped public buildings, and Adolf Hitler's speeches flooded the airwaves. The Nazis were in full control of Germany. Over the next few years, Berlin bullied and bloodied its neighbors. Germany expanded its military presence on its border, annexed neighboring Austria, intensified Spain's brutal civil war, and initiated its diabolical anti-Jewish campaign at home. In 1938, the British Prime Minister appeased Hitler's demands at Munich by carving Czechoslovakia in half. Meanwhile, Berlin's Axis allies were wreaking havoc in other parts of the globe. In 1931, Japan occupied Manchuria and began to extend its brutal rule across China. Italy staged a savage invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. Germany's blitzkrieg assault in Poland on September 1, 1939, officially started World War II and pulled most of Europe into the fighting. By mid-1940, half of Europe had fallen, and Hitler's Luftwaffe began to bomb British civilians in London, Liverpool, Birmingham, Sheffield, Coventry, and elsewhere. This became known as the Blitz. With tanks rolling across Europe and bombs falling on British cities, Christian scholar C.S. Lewis gave a speech at Oxford entitled, "Why I Am Not a Pacifist." He published the text of the speech as an essay several months later. In the midst of a world war, why would Lewis have felt the need to argue against pacifism? Was the pull toward pacifism really a risk for British people experiencing a national emergency as the Nazis attacked their homeland? The answer is yes. The Great War of 1914 through 1918 had been so horrific and debilitating that many British citizens and politicians shrank from the horrors of another conflict with Germany, putting their trust in proclamations and treaties that purported to outlaw war. Just how destructive was the First World War? France and England together lost nearly 2 million men. The estimate of Russian losses ranges from 775,000 to 1.7 million men. Germany and Austria-Hungary together lost nearly 3 million. The United States only actively participated in World War I for 1 year, but during that time, America lost the equivalent of 10,000 soldiers per month. And these numbers do not account for millions of wounded military personnel, civilian deaths, disease and famine, and then the ravages of the Spanish flu epidemic that troops carried around the world when they returned home. Trench warfare, barbed wire, poison gas. World War I was a ghastly experience of modern total warfare, ruining civilian property and infrastructure in addition to lives. With the horrors of World War I still vivid in European memory 20 years later, the frantic hope not to do anything that might result in another war caused a moral paralysis. Many British leaders and citizens had become pragmatic, not principled, pacifists. Their pragmatism was rooted in fear. War is too destructive. We simply cannot go to war again. In practice, that sentiment meant ignoring German and Japanese atrocities, looking the other way as long as their own country could stay out of the conflict. Of course, Britain soon learned it could not stay out of the war by keeping its head down. The British government's policy of appeasing Hitler during the early 1930s, far from containing his aggressive campaign within his own region, had brought the bombs to the British Isles. Britain's moral weakness provoked Hitler's bullying, as did the worthless pieces of paper that claimed to make war illegal. The situation also provoked moral clarity and courage among critics of Britain's policy of avoiding war at all costs. C.S. Lewis was one such critic, and he argued against pacifism at Oxford. Lewis was not some ivory tower academic theorizing about security without ever having to experience the conditions of war himself. He served as a lieutenant in the trenches and was severely wounded in 1918. Many of his closest friends died during the Great War. Just a few months after he was medically discharged in December 1918, he published a volume of poetry, Spirits and Bondage, which railed at any god that could countenance such devastation. Over the years, Lewis left his atheism for the Christian faith, but he never became a pacifist. Indeed, during World War II, he called the pragmatic pacifism of the 1930s that enabled Hitler wishful thinking. For Lewis, war was not something new, a novel political condition, but rather a reality of life in a fallen world. In a previous address to Oxford students, he argued, "The war creates no absolutely new situation. It simply aggravates the permanent human situation so that we can no longer ignore it. Human culture has always had to exist under the shadow of something infinitely more important than itself." That was the experience of Lewis and his generation. The tragedy of World War I forced an entire society to ask questions about morality, war, and peace. In Lewis's case, he concluded that we do live in a world of right and wrong, justice and injustice, and moral accountability. He continued to believe that people and governments have a duty to fight evil when it presents itself, with the practical goal of seeking peace. These actions are the day-to-day vigilance of statesmen, warriors, and public officials. At his 1940 Oxford lecture, he told the students, "It may be asked whether, faint as the hope is of abolishing war by pacifism, there is any other hope. But the question belongs to a mode of thought which I find quite alien to me. It consists in assuming that the great permanent miseries in human life might be curable if only we can find the right cure. And it then proceeds by elimination and concludes that whatever is left, however unlikely to prove a cure, must nevertheless do so. Hence the fanaticism of Marxists, Freudians, and all the rest. But I have received no assurance that anything we can do will eradicate suffering. I think the best results are obtained by people who work quietly away at limited objectives, such as the abolition of the slave trade, or prison reform, or tuberculosis, not by those who think they can achieve universal justice, or health, or peace. I think the art of life consists of tackling each immediate evil as well as we can. To avert or postpone one particular war by wise policy, or to render one particular campaign shorter by strength and skill, or less terrible by mercy to the conquered and the civilians, is more useful than all the proposals for a universal peace that have ever been made. In sum, because peace is a perennial aspiration of human beings, and strife is always a risk in the midst of our fallen condition, Balancing these realities and taking appropriate action are among the most serious challenges that a society and its leaders must address. Throughout the 1930s, many citizens asked questions about war and peace. The same kind of questions returned in the 1990s as ruthless tyrants in the Middle East and Balkans started to slaughter some of their fellow citizens and their immediate neighbors. Since 9/11, we continue to ask whether the use of force and its potential moral and physical destructiveness is legitimate. Christians in particular may have such questions. If Christians are called to love our neighbors, how can we support war? How could we justify violence if Christians are called to peace? Questions like these deserve answers. Some people in the 1930s used such questions rhetorically to avoid taking responsibility in the face of Hitler's aggression. They used heady calls to peace and love to rally anti-war sentiment while avoiding serious reflection about what the moral concepts peace and neighbor love actually require. Lewis lectured at Oxford, on BBC radio broadcasts, and across the country, addressing these questions because he knew the Christian tradition has answers to these questions. Theological teaching about peace, love, and justice runs deep through Christian history, but it is not the stuff of musty library books. It requires action today. This book is about pursuing peace based on justice in the conduct of statecraft. Statecraft is the skillful political leadership of a country, including as it relates to other countries. Effective statecraft draws on the wisdom of past experience and is buttressed by moral commitment. Christian reflection on statecraft should draw on what the Bible and theological reflection on it have taught us over the centuries about human beings living together in community. Christian thinkers offer particular wisdom about the responsibility of government to provide order and justice. That tradition is called the just war tradition, and its essential feature is a commitment to conducting statecraft in a way that pursues peace with justice. Toward a just peace. What is peace? Standard definitions usually begin with a phrase such as freedom from or a state of. Some define peace as freedom from disturbance, oppression, or attack, whereas others describe peace as a state of harmony, right relationships, or agreement among individuals or groups. It all sounds good, but it also sounds fuzzy. Looking at Scripture, we can discern several forms of peace. Christians are told, "Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts," Colossians chapter 3, verse 15. Christians are also directed to maintain interpersonal peace. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Romans chapter 12, verse 18. Interestingly, just four verses after live peaceably with all, Paul shifts from the individual's responsibility to avoid wrathful vengeance to government's responsibility to bring justice to evildoers and provide security to society. Thomas Aquinas helpfully discusses these types of peace. The first is internal, and for Christians, reflects the spiritual dimension of God's grace causing wholeness, shalom, in our lives. Aquinas rightly notes that such peace is related to love, love of God and love of neighbor. A second form of peace is external peace, meaning relations between individuals, relations among communities and societies, and the role that government plays in securing peace. Quoting Augustine, Aquinas speaks of this external peace as concord. Groups of people can be in concord because they are united in the desire to preserve or advance the general common good, but they can also choose a more limited cooperation that protects a good against some evil. One vision of concord can be found in the beautiful words of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. Note the emphasis on forming a better political union focused on justice, peace, domestic tranquility, and the general welfare. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. This is a robust concord, peace, based on shared loves of law, justice, and collective security. It seeks this peace for all citizens, both present and future. It is a form of societal neighbor love. The term tranquility goes all the way back to Augustine, who in the late 4th century called political peace in this world the tranquility of order. Tranquillitas ordinis. There are narrower forms of concord, what we would call alliances of convenience, which work towards some form of shared good. A limited treaty, concordat, or pact, such as that between the Democratic U.S. and the Communist Soviet Union, 1941 through 45, to fight the Nazis, is a sort of partial concord.
It is a form of collaboration designed to protect each country, but it is not a truly ordered tranquility between like-minded peoples embracing the same values and virtues.
With these definitions of peace in mind, what about turning the other cheek? Compare Matthew chapter 5, verse 39. Shouldn't that be the foundation for thinking about peace? Lewis rightly argued that a fallen world demands that we think about peace in terms of a responsibility to protect. Lewis told his Oxford audience, "Does anyone suppose that our Lord's hearers understood him to mean that if a homicidal maniac attempting to murder a third party tried to knock me out of the way, I must stand aside and let him get his victim?" The just war tradition is actually a quest for peace. Just war statecraft, or just statecraft, is properly understood as peace-seeking, not just in terms of aspiration, but also in terms of constructive action. As we will discuss, it does so in a number of ways. First, by acknowledging that political authorities are responsible for promoting the good and deterring evil. It provides guidance on appropriate, just causes for employing restrained force with right intentions. In the conduct of war, it defines limits on how force is used. Finally, at war's end, just statecraft directs policies and activities toward public order, justice, and ultimately conciliation. Pearl Harbor and the principles of just war statecraft. Early on the morning of December 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan launched an all-out invasion of the Pacific. One of the largest coordinated assaults in history, the attacks ranged from Singapore, Hong Kong, and the Philippines to Guam, Wake Island, and Midway Island. Within weeks, it resulted in the largest British surrender in history at Singapore. In the Philippines, although General MacArthur escaped, vowing, "I will return." 75,000 Allied troops surrendered and were forced on the hellish Bataan Death March. Sunday, December 7th, was declared by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, FDR, as a day of infamy that would be remembered forever. What made the attack infamous? It was not just the scale, but the treachery. Japan's diplomats had placidly pretended that the two governments were in a period of negotiation. No one expected the evil of a sneak attack on a Sunday morning without a declaration of war. While many people slept or were preparing for church, 353 Japanese aircraft devastated the U.S. naval installation at Pearl Harbor. 11 ships were sunk, with others damaged, most famously the battleship USS Arizona, sank when its ammunition repository exploded. Over 2,403 Americans were killed. Another 1,178 were wounded. It seems obvious that Washington had to do something. But what exactly? Who was to do it? What were the moral and legal grounds for the response? President Roosevelt's answer presupposed the basic elements of just war statecraft. We will go into much greater detail in later chapters, but for now, let's explore how Roosevelt's words and actions illustrate the basic principles of just war statecraft. Just war statecraft begins with the proposition that government officials have a responsibility to protect and defend the people and property within their charge. This is the principle of legitimate authority. It makes an important distinction. It is the role of government, not private citizens, to provide this protection, whether it be law enforcement, thwarting and arresting criminals, or military operations to defeat terrorists, or international criminal networks, or to counter foreign attacks. Private citizens are generally not authorized to use lethal force, but President Roosevelt, as commander-in-chief, was the right person to oversee protection and defense, that is, the prosecution of the war. Congress complied with his request and declared war on December 8, 1941. Protect and defend suggests that there are just and unjust grounds for governments to employ military force. Just war statecraft asserts that just causes for using force are generally defensive in some way. In the 5th century, Augustine argued that just causes include protecting the vulnerable, punishing wrongdoers, and preventing additional wrong. All three of these just causes are important roles for legitimate authority, and all three are limited. For instance, government must always be vigilant about protecting the vulnerable and preventing harm. A country is less likely to be attacked if it demonstrates a high level of security preparedness. In other words, deterrence, prevention, is a just cause for investing in a powerful and prepared military. At times, national defense requires a more active posture, as occurred in the U.S. response to Pearl Harbor. The U.S. responded by fighting back and ultimately defeating Japan. Punishment as a just cause is highly contextual. At home, domestic law enforcement has courts, prisons, and a constitutional legal apparatus. The arena of war between nation states is different. We will examine the concepts of retribution, punishment of aggression, and restoration, restitution for victims, both of which are politically and financially challenging during conflict and after war's end. Legitimate authorities may employ military force on behalf of a just cause. but they are required to do so with proper ethical motivations. This is what just war statecraft calls right intention. Augustine writes that greed, hatred, and lust are sinful motivations, but love of neighbor and the desire to thwart evil are appropriate motivations to use force in the pursuit of peace. At the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, Japan had a history of aggression, including three previous wars against either China or Russia in the previous 40 years. In 1931, Japan launched its campaign to subdue or enslave large parts of Chinese territory, a campaign that developed over time into what may be best described as the Three Alls policy: burn all, kill all, loot all. On December 7, 1941, Japan launched coordinated attacks from Singapore to Hawaii. Tokyo's premeditated assaults on its neighbors were in no way a war with just cause and right intention. Our response to this aggression from Washington and its allies, however, was clearly a just cause and could be motivated by right intention: to prevent additional harm by punishing the attackers. Roosevelt spoke of bringing righteous might to bear against Japan with a determination to triumph and end such threats to the American people. Note that he did not speak of hating the Japanese people, nor did he use the language of bitter vengeance or dehumanize the enemy. This is just war statecraft's foundation. Legitimate political authorities have a responsibility to protect and defend those in their charge, just cause, and should do so with restraint in motivation and action, right intention. Just war statecraft also provides secondary, prudential criteria about how to make practical decisions in the context of national security threats. Among these are the likelihood of success and the proportionality of ends. Is a military response proportionate to the threat or grievance? In the case of Pearl Harbor and related attacks across the Pacific region, the answer was obviously affirmative. Just war statesmen also must consider the likelihood of success of their strategies. We expect leaders to be good stewards of the resources at their disposal, from tax dollars to the lives of the men and women at their command. We expect leaders to carefully count the cost of various courses of action and direct their policies toward peace and security, not costly vengeance. The final condition of just war statecraft is reaching the conclusion that all other options have been exhausted and the restrained use of force is the only remaining possibility for restoring peace. This criterion is referred to as reasonable last resort. On December 7, 1941, the U.S. and Japan were in the process of serious diplomatic negotiations. Previously, the U.S. had imposed an oil embargo to criticize and restrict Japan's horrific attacks on civilians in China. After December 7th, the use of force truly was a last resort for the U.S. When the decision to go to war has been made, there are three just war criteria for how war is fought: military necessity, proportionality, and discrimination, i.e., making right distinctions. Each emphasizes stewardship and restraint. Military necessity is the basic concept that military leaders on the ground should make every effort at battlefield victory to achieve the just cause using lawful means. Necessity is balanced by proportionality, meaning that the weapons and tactics employed on a particular battlefield at a particular time should be proportionate to the type of fighting occurring. It would be ridiculous and disproportionate to obliterate a sniper.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?